Coming up on Golf Today, it is U.S. Open Media Day at Pinehurst No. 2. We'll take you there with a number of guests. How will the course play and what will be different in the sand hills of North Carolina this time around? Brooks Koepka has won two U.S. Opens and he has been tearing it up on LIV. Where do you have Brooks among the favorites for next week's PGA? Can he go back-to-back again? And the best golfer in the world is back this week. Can Nelly win for the sixth straight time? Should we just give her the trophy now? We dissect the greatness of Nelly coming up on Golf Today.
Golf Today.
Hope you had a great weekend. This is Golf Today on a Monday. Damon Hack alongside Eamon Lynch, Golf Week Magazine. I watched the end of that CJ Cup, Byron Nelson. My goodness, we saw the beauty and the brutality of golf in about an eight-minute span.
Yeah, it was a reminder that there really isn't much that separates ecstasy from despair in this game. And you got a feel for Ben Coles. I mean, it's a guy who he missed one fairway all day, and it was the last fairway, and it wasn't by much. Hit what seemed to be a pretty good second shot. Chip got away from him, and suddenly he's standing there watching Taylor Pendrith with the trophy. And, you know, we keep hearing a lot these days, I suppose, Damon, about how these lower profile PGA Tour stops don't mean as much. I didn't see much evidence that it didn't mean much to those guys yesterday, either the winner or, sadly, the guy who walked away who probably felt as though he should have had the trophy.
Yeah, Taylor Pendrith, the Canadian, perhaps on the verge of a second straight appearance for the international team in the President's Cup. Another winner over the weekend, by the way. Brooks Koepka, did you see what he did? Shot a 3-under round of 68 Sunday to finish at 15-under to win the LIV Golf event in Singapore. Eamon, he finished two shots ahead of Cameron Smith and Mark Leishman. The win is Koepka's fourth career victory on LIV, sharing it with the family. As you can see, Koepka, of course, a five-time major champion, his most recent major heist coming last year at the PGA at Oak Hill. Win on Sunday in Singapore is timely as the next men's major of 2024 begins next week with the PGA Championship at Valhalla. So why don't we take a look at the odds to win the second men's major? You see Scotty Scheffler plus 350. Then you got Rory. Then you got Rombo. Then you get to Brooks Koepka at 16-1, sharing that number with Ludvig Åberg. I tell you what, Eamon. Some of the guys left the PGA Tour for LIV and have disappeared. You know, Brooks Koepka is not one of those guys, especially when it comes to major championships. Some guys talked about growing the game globally and this and that. I thought they were flabby, nebulous answers, if I'm honest. But Brooks Koepka seems to be the same guy he's always been.
And it's interesting to see that he's the second favorite LIV guy in the bookies' minds behind Jon Rahm. I bet he doesn't think he's second favorite right now. Rahm's played consistent golf on LIV, hasn't been a winner out there. But it, again, it shows the ebbs and flows of this game. Last week, early in the week in Singapore, Koepka was talking about a certain downness in his game, that he couldn't find the hole with a putter. By the end of the week, he's talking about how easy this game feels at sometimes. And, you know, we're heading to a state that's known for thoroughbreds next week in Kentucky. And thoroughbreds don't come much better than Brooks Koepka in majors. When you look at the five wins, four second-place finishes. He's been fourth twice. He's been sixth twice. And that's just since 2017. Nobody else has a record remotely comparable to Brooks Koepka's in the majors over the last 7 years. It's a lot of it with him. It comes down to two things. The confidence, which one assumes he has now, and the chip on the shoulder, whatever he uses to motivate him in a given week. And earlier in his career, I think it was always the, where's the fake feud?
Right.
He could drum up. And his coach, Claude Harmon, was always very good at feeding him those kind of things early in the week to kind of G him up a little bit for the week. And it worked a lot with him. I don't sense that he needs that any less now. So I wouldn't be surprised if he starts getting himself worked up about something between now and then. But he's got to be considered the LIV favourite. I mean, to your point, I think he has single-handedly kept LIV players relevant in major championships over the last couple of years. You know, we can point to Phil Mickelson being second with Koepka at the Masters last year, but Phil Mickelson also had a tremendous amount of institutional knowledge of that golf course and has not factored anywhere else since. Koepka not only almost won the Masters, probably should have won the Masters, he won the PGA Championship. And, you know, he was T45 at the Masters this year. I think that kind of fired him up a little bit for what's to come.
Yeah, I completely agree with you about the motivational tactics of Brooks and his coach Klotharmer III. I think it used to be, well, you know, Justin Thomas and Jordan Spieth were kind of the fair-haired golden boys of the AJGA circuit and the college golf scene, and Brooks had to go to the Challenge Tour and the former European Tour, now the DP World Tour, to kind of find his feet and his place in this game. But he could have left the PGA Tour for the moon, and I think he still would have found a way to compete in major championships. And when I spoke to Claude before the Masters, he said, listen, Brooks Koepka sees major championships as the ultimate stress test in this game. He said it's like being on Mount Everest. And he said Brooks believes that other players, they talk about wanting the ball in the final seconds of a game, but he doesn't think that in the heart of hearts they do. Brooks Koepka thrives in those moments, whether he's on the PGA Tour or LIV Golf. He believes history and major championships are the most important currency in this game.
And that's why he's proven to be a fairly lousy propagandist for LIV in that sense. I mean, Brooks made no secret of the fact when he was on the PGA Tour that he didn't really care about the other 48 weeks of the year.
He did say that yeah.
The majors were what was going to define his legacy. It's all he cared about. So the idea that he was actually going to care about the 14 LIV events in any given year never quite added up either. And that hasn't registered with some people, because there was an interesting tweet at the weekend by Phil Mickelson when he kind of vaguely threatened that at some point LIV players might actually not play majors at all in protest. And, you know, would they be missed? What about next year when more great players join, or the following year? And essentially trying to force an issue where the majors would have to allow LIV players in, otherwise none of them will play, that it's all or none. And it just shows how much bluster Phil is capable of producing, detached from any reality. Because I would pay good cash money to see Phil Mickelson suggest to Jon Rahm or Brooks Koepka that they ought to boycott major championships because Taylor Gooch or Joaquin Neiman aren't getting a start. Good luck with that.
You think Jon Rahm and Phil Mickelson aren't going to show up for the first major championship of the year at any point?
Well, Phil's the guy, because he won the PGA Championship, a great victory 3 years ago. Phil's in most of the majors for the foreseeable future. So he's actually gambling with somebody else's money here and saying that these guys aren't going to show up for majors. Well, a lot of those guys aren't getting major starts because of what Phil told them they would get going to LIV in the first place.
Well, one of the big questions and talking points about LIV golf was, would the bulk of the players remain razor sharp, match tough, as it were? Gary Player talked about that. Why would you leave, you know, the PGA Tour with the best players in the world and play week to week if you can maintain, you know, that opportunity to win major championships? You know, Brooks Koepka is one of those guys that's proven that you can. I think most of the players, a lot of them have disappeared. I mean, Cameron Smith has bubbled up from time to time. You know, Patrick Reed's had a moment here or there. Bryson DeChambeau had a few days at Augusta National. But for the most part, we have seen a bit of a degradation, I believe, in the quality of the LIV golfers, at least when it comes to major championship performance, outside of Brooks Koepka in particular.
Yeah, I think the jury's still out on that to some degree, Damon. I mean, a lot of the guys who went to LIV didn't really have much runway left in front of them career-wise anyway, in terms of being competitively relevant. They were cashing out at the end of their career. Now I think we have a more interesting setup this year. Koepka's sort of been something of an outlier the last couple of years. Cameron Smith's been a strange one. He's definitely fallen off. But what we'll see out of Jon Rahm, and perhaps even Tyrrell Hatton as well, and Joaquin Neiman. Neiman played well when he's played outside of LIV.
He has.
And inside of LIV. You know, he won the Australian Open. He's played well on the DP World Tour. Does that continue through this year? To me, that's the interesting one to watch, particularly with Jon Rahm.
One thing we know, the specter of Brooks Koepka looms large next week at Valhalla. Meanwhile, on the PGA Tour, time for Winning Moments, presented by Wynn Grips. In case you missed it, Taylor Pendrith took the title of the CJ Cup Byron Nelson on Sunday. The Canadian birdied the 72nd hole to win by a single shot over Ben Coles. Eamon, as you mentioned, bogeyed that final hole after taking the lead with a birdie at the 71st. And with the win, Pendrith earns 500 FedEx Cup points and is fully exempt through the 2026 season. Also earns a spot in the PGA Championship and the remaining signature events this year.
And that was his first victory on the PGA Tour in his 74th start. And he joins a roster of first-time winners on tour this year. Nick Dunlap at the American Express, Mathieu Pavon, the Farmers, Jake Knapp in Mexico, Austin Eckroat down in Palm Beach, and of course, Stephen Yeager, the Texas Children's Hospital Open. And he got some congratulations from one of his countrymen, Adam Hadwin. Nice playing, Taylor Pendrith. another victory for Canada. Mike Weir must be a happy guy these days.
No doubt. And Taylor did not get tackled from what I saw after breaking through in Dallas. All right, folks, before we get to break, let's check on the Comcast Business Tour Top 10. With his win on Sunday, Penrith moves to number 34 in the FedEx Cup standings. There you see the 10 guys at the top. A lot of smiling faces. Worth noting that since 2009, every player who finished in the Comcast Business Tour Top 10 has made it to the Tour Championship at East Lake. So if players finish in the Top 10, Eamon, odds are they're going to make it to the Tour Championship.
Well, we're closing in on the second men's major of the year, but it's media day for the third one. That's the US Open at Pinehurst number two. And we've got Pinehurst number one with us. It's Tom Pashley, president of the resort. He's going to give us the latest on the preparations coming up next.
We're back on Golf Today. In case you missed it, news on Thursday, the USGA announced that three-time US Open champ Tiger Woods accepted a special exemption in the 124th U.S. Open Championship, which will be contested June 13th through the 16th on Pinehurst Resort and Country Club number 2 in the Village, Pinehurst, North Carolina. Tiger had this statement: the U.S. Open, our national championship, is a truly special event for our game and one that has helped define my career. I'm honored to receive this exemption and could not be more excited for the opportunity to compete in this year's U.S. Open, especially at Pinehurst, a venue that means so much to the game.
Indeed, one of the most historic places in all of golf. This is the fourth U.S. Open to be played at Pinehurst, of course, 1999, the famous Payne Stewart victory, Michael Campbell in 2005, Martin Kaymer, a runaway winner 10 years ago, and who's going to do it again next month? Well, a man who's been there for all of those Opens at Pinehurst is Tom Pashley, the president of Pinehurst Resort, who joins us now. Tom, where are you in the build-out and preparation process here? Are you feeling pressure? Are you feeling confident? Or is it a little bit of both?
It's definitely a little bit of both. There's a lot happening. They're building the small city that the U.S. Open becomes. I haven't had a chance to play number two yet, but when you come up 18, the scene is unbelievable. You've got the large grandstands on the golfer's left. On the right, you have the big video board and some corporate hospitality. It frames in so nicely. I think you feel like you're playing in the U.S. Open if you're out there right now.
In past, you spent most of your adult life at Pinehurst in various roles. You know, what's the biggest difference, would you say, between the late 1990s to today?
Yeah, you know, expectations were low in 1999 when we hosted the first U.S. Open. There was a big question mark about whether, you know, this small community in the middle of North Carolina could handle the U.S. Open and the infrastructure and the crowds and everything that comes with it. And now, 25 years later, to have been crowned an anchor site and to know that we're going to be hosting U.S. Opens all the way through 2047, I think is the biggest wow, that we've gone from kind of being a question mark to an exclamation point is one of the game's greatest venues for the U.S. Open. We're really proud of that.
Just on that point of being an anchor site, Tom, you're only going to have to wait 5 years until there's another Open at Pinehurst in 29. Then it's only 6 years after that. Are you at a point where some of the infrastructure you're building for the Open could just simply be permanent because you are going to have these recurring championships with such a little gap that wouldn't necessarily be a consideration for other venues that might host an Open championship maybe every 10 or 12 years?
That's absolutely correct. That's part of the anchor site strategy, really, Eamon, is that you're able to plan for the future. And for instance, the USGA has put in, you know, permanent power now so that we don't have diesel generators running that are loud and not great for the environment. They've done some permanent roadways. We've been able to make some renovations in our buildings that we know will assist the player experience. And so we've done a lot between the last US Open and the one in 2024, but I think every time now between Opens, we'll be able to make enhancements so that it's one of the best U.S. Open experiences that you can actually have.
I would imagine that infrastructure is very important, especially in light of the news that Tiger Woods has accepted the special exemption from the USGA. Give us a sense of what the reaction was like in the offices at Pinehurst when you found out that Tiger would be there, even if we don't know what the state of his game will be.
Well, yeah, there was cheers. You know, we're all excited to have Tiger here. You certainly hope that he's going to play well. He was right there at the end in 1999. And again, he was a big factor in 2005. And so, yeah, when you think of champions that you'd love to have at your venue, having Tiger, be relevant and make the cut hopefully this year and contend would be really exciting for everybody in the community.
That 1999 Open that was won by Payne Stewart when Tiger was right in the mix there as well, Tom, has become such an iconic moment, perhaps the most iconic moment in the long storied history of golf at Pinehurst. What can fans expect during the Open next month in terms of commemorating that particular moment?
Yeah, well, one of the most, you know, highly trafficked areas is where the Payne Stewart statue sits, right behind the 18th green of Pinehurst number 2. Everybody stops there and poses and takes the photo. And the USGA is actually going to move the statue from where it sits today and put it out front at the main admission gate, where kind of the fan central experience is going to be. And so all the fans attending the championship will have the opportunity to interact with that trophy in a space that's going to be a lot more beautiful so that they can take their photo. I know there's also some augmented reality things, so fans all across the world will be able to virtually pose with that statue. I think there'll be several nods to Payne and his wonderful win throughout the week in a couple of weeks.
Pat, one of the things I love about Pinehurst when I visited a decade ago was how it can embrace the future but also kind of keep that slow living, easy lifestyle as well. What's been the reaction to the addition of Pinehurst number 10? I saw some pictures of Tom Doak's creation and I was blown away.
Yeah, people have responded very well to number 10, and thank you for your comments. We do try to, you know, keep one eye in the past but take some aggressive steps forward to continue to innovate here at a destination that's 125 years old. So number 10, you know, is a response to just needing more golf inventory. Golf is booming right now, and so we needed that additional golf course. Tom Doak did a wonderful job building it. It has some super interesting land formations. It's on the site of a former sand mine. And so when you get out there, for instance, on the 8th hole, someone likened it to playing down the spine of a dragon. You have a 30-foot mound that you hit a blind tee shot over, and then a fairway that has a lot of rumples. It's generous and wide off the tee, but it has some really interesting contours on the greens, as you would expect from any Tom Doak course. People have really responded well to it, and we're excited for more people to see it. It's only been open about a month.
This is it seems to be a permanent season of change at Pinehurst in a lot of ways. Tom, you had Gil Hanse do Pinehurst number 4. You opened the Cradle course. Now Tom Doak with course number 10. What's next? Because it doesn't seem as though you get an awful lot of time to rest on your laurels down there.
Well, we're fortunate to have the Dedman family who own Pinehurst, and they want to see us continue to stay relevant. So we've done a tremendous amount of renovation work aiming throughout the hotels. We're talking about adding some restaurants. As we add more golf, we might need to add additional rooms. We're building golf cottages. Imagine this, the first rooms with a golf view at Pinehurst are under construction now at Pinehurst number 8. So we have room to grow. The land where number 10 sits, there's about 500 more acres that we can develop. So we do envision one day having golf cottages out there, additional short courses, and potentially another 18-hole course at the site that we are now referring to as Pinehurst Sand Mines, which would be the home of Pinehurst number 10 and whatever else follows.
Pash, want to fast forward to Sunday evening, Father's Day, U.S. Open Sunday, the champion with the trophy and the gloaming with the caddy and the family. What is your hope that the golf fan and those on the ground have experienced that week?
Boy, I hope that they've been able to kind of absorb a little bit of the spirit of Pinehurst. You know, the Pinehurst is a special place. I've been here, like you said, for most of my adult life, but there really is something kind of magical and special about it. And we really want people when they come here to kind of connect with the soul of the game and feel the spirit of Pinehurst. It is filled with, you know, footsteps of legends and ghosts of the past. And so I think there's so much here for people to love. We just hope that everyone who is here has a way to connect with some special moment and take a little bit of Pinehurst home with them.
We know, Tom, that this is one of the rare venues where Joe Public can actually go play a U.S. Open golf course, but they can't necessarily play it as it's set up for the U.S. Open to just understand how brutally exacting a test these guys face over those 4 days. Have you ever considered having a day or several days where the retail golfer can actually pay for the experience and go and play that golf course exactly as it is set up for those guys?
You know, if you throw pace of play to the wind, you could certainly do that. And we've done it from time to time. You know, we do get close to it, Eamon, every year during our North and South Amateur. We do have some of the best amateur players in the world who will come. So if you happen to be a resort guest during that time, you are playing the greens that are running almost U.S. Open speeds. We do like to think that Pinehurst number two really plays like a U.S. Open course almost every day, because we're not narrowing the fairways. We're not growing up any rough. It is the way it is. The only difference really during the U.S. Open is the firmness and the speed of the greens. So you kind of get that U.S. Open experience without the whole locations in the corners just about any time you play number two.
Pash, you recall the golf course was closed from early 2010 to 2011 when Bill Corr and Ben Crenshaw renovated the course, brought it back to its Donald Ross bones. But there was some criticism about that undertaking. Any sense of vindication at how many rounds have been played and how the golf course has been returned to its original state as much as possible?
Yeah, thank you for bringing that up. You know, it was a risk at the time. Number two was going to be hosting the 2014 U.S. Open, and we made the decision. It had nothing to do with the U.S. Open, but we made the decision to take Pinehurst number two back to the Donald Ross aesthetic and rip away 30 acres of manicured rough and replace it with that sandy wire grass. And some people thought it was a crazy move. It was universally accepted and applauded. It really frames the golf course now so that it's not just monochromatic green everywhere you look. Our roughs are no longer 3 inches of Bermuda grass. Our roughs are sandy wiregrass pine straw, and you might get a perfect green light hard pan lie from it, or you may be hovering 3 inches above the ground in a wiregrass plant. But no, people have really enjoyed it, and it takes Pinehurst back to its roots. And whenever we use our history to help set our future, it seems to work well.
No doubt, though. I can miss a fairway no matter how wide it is. Pash, it's great to see you. Can't wait to see you next month for the U.S. Open.
Look forward to having you guys. Thank you.
All right, he is Tom Pashley, president of Pinehurst. And the road to the 124th U.S. Open at Pinehurst is underway. Local qualifying taking place until May 20th. The players who advance out of local will join a group of locally exempt players in final qualifying, which will be conducted over 36 holes. This final stage will be held in England, Japan, and Canada, as well as 10 U.S. sites on May 20th and 900 on June the 3rd, which is golf's longest day. You know it well. You know the name. Our coverage begins that Monday at noon Eastern time. Some interesting stories to keep your eyes on this week. Andrew Pacey, who is married to Scottie Scheffler's sister, Callie, will begin his U.S. Open qualifying journey today at Escondido Golf and Lake Club in Horseshoe Bay, Texas. Andrew is an account executive for the family's insurance company, met Callie when they both played at Texas A&M University. He advanced to the quarterfinals of the 2022 U.S. Mid-Am at Erin Hills and qualified for last year's U.S. Amateur. And 20-year-old Jack Cantlay, the younger brother of 8-time PGA Tour winner Patrick Cantlay, will attempt to qualify at Andalusia Country Club in La Quinta, California on Tuesday. Stay with us, folks. Big week in store on the LPGA Tour as world number one Nelly Korda returns to action at the Cognizant Founders Cup. Could be an historic week in the game as she looks to win her sixth straight start. We preview next.
We're back on Golf Today. It's been a heck of a year for world number one Nelly Korda, and we're not even halfway through. 5 consecutive wins on the LPGA Tour, including the Chevron Championship, her second major title. She took some time off following that, but returns to action this week at the Cognizant Founders Cup. And this is the event where the LPGA pays tribute to its founding members. It's being played in New Jersey for the 4th straight year at Upper Montclair Country Club, and for the 3rd year in a row at that venue. Coverage begins Thursday at 7 p.m. Eastern time right here on Golf Channel.
Like Upper Montclair, sweet spot. Meanwhile, the PGA Tour heads to Quail Hollow Club in Charlotte, North Carolina for the Wells Fargo Championship. This is the 6th of 8 signature events on the PGA Tour this year. Limited field will be competing for a $20 million purse. Let's remind you of the signature event winners we've seen so far in 2024. Chris Kirk, Wyndham Clark, Hideki Matsuyama, and then Scottie Scheffler. What a run he has been on, though not in the field this week. Got it done again at the RBC. And there you see the 3 remaining signature events of 2024. Let's keep the conversation going and welcome in Golf Week senior writer Beth Ann Nichols and Sirius XM PGA Tour Radio's Taylor Zarzer. Wonderful to see you both. Beth Ann, I want to start with you. You've been covering the LPGA for a long, long time. This Nelly Korda story, comparable to Annika back in the day, Lydia Ko, bigger, smaller, how would you classify it?
Building. I think we'll know more after this week. You know, I definitely think there's this feeling that a lot of folks had that we wish that she had continued playing on into Wilshire, after that fantastic, finish at the Chevron, that she then, took 2 weeks off, maybe took a little bit of the buzz away for a while, but hopefully it's building. And I think we might see this week her do some special things, I'm hoping, that are a little outside the box for the tour. That's what the LPGA really needs.
Hey, Taylor, are you taking Nelly or taking the field? That's a tough bet this week.
I mean, I would want to say Nelly because I think it's great for the women's game if she wins. I don't know after a week off, how that form lasts. It's such a fickle thing, keeping that momentum going. But I love what the word that Beth Ann just chose for her and for the sport. This is a great story. We've had a lot of junk that we've been talking about in the last couple of years in professional golf, and women's golf has a great story behind someone that has the best swing in the game, men or women included. And I think that what Beth Ann said is true. We could sit here and we could say, well, I wish she would do more media or promote the game as much as possible. But to her point, if she goes and wins in Jersey this week, or if she is to win the U.S. Women's Open, in my mind, the biggest event in women's golf at the end of May and into early June, then none of what's happened in the last couple of weeks or how much we've seen her is going to matter. It'll be a massive story if that happens.
There's some chatter this week, Beth Ann, with the Wells Fargo Championship. Scottie Scheffler is the only prominent player who's not there. The occasional rumbling that the event is somehow diminished when the dominant number one isn't there. Did you feel as though that was the case when the LPGA Tour went to LA and Nelly decided to stay home? Or is this just a narrative that goes hand in hand when you have a player on a dominant stretch that somehow the week feels diminished when they're not actually playing?
Yeah, I think that feeling is inevitable. And I think the rest of the field felt like they finally had a chance. Obviously, Hannah Green appreciated it. And it was a big week for her. But, I think no matter going forward, any week that Nelly Korda takes off at this point, it's going to feel a little bit like a downer, probably a little bit more so at Wilshire, simply because she was in the midst of such an incredible tear and you thought she could take advantage of some of the media opportunities in LA that LPGA players rarely have a chance to do. So thankfully, this event is really close to New York City. So hopefully we see something there. It's my understanding that we might see something special in the works from her team and the LPGA coming forward this week.
Taylor, don't we need to see more, though? I thought that was a very interesting column in USA Today saying that this should be golf's Caitlin Clark moment and that we as the sport collectively haven't quite captured it, whether it's Nelly's reluctance maybe to be more out front or whether it's the LPGA right, not building it enough or whether it's television's fault not building the story enough. With all the little girls that are supposedly picking up golf clubs these days, why isn't this story even bigger than it is?
It's a great question. I'm excited to hear that golf's best or the LPGA Tour's best insider just teased us in what may be happening in the next week or two, because we need stuff like that. We need her on the Today Show if she's going to be in that area. We need her to be doing mainstream media opportunities as much as she's willing to do. She said a couple of weeks ago after winning the Chevron that we need better coverage of the women's game in prime time. And I totally agree with that. But we also need the biggest name front-facing out there doing it for us. And I'm not suggesting that she go from a 1 to 10 in terms of how much time and how big of a commitment she's making to promoting the game. I'm asking her to go from, say, a 4 to a 6. But to your point, Damon, it is a wonderful story. It's something that we should be all excited to promote. And I'm with you. The more the general public gets access to her to watch that swing, to watch how mild-mannered, kind, level-headed she is, the way that she supports the game, the more that she'll gain fans all over the world, similarly to what you just referenced with Caitlin Clark.
Taylor, I want to go back to the Wells Fargo Championship for a moment. Webb Simpson, who lives at Quail Hollow, is in the field on a sponsor's exemption. It's the fourth one he's gotten into a signature event this year. Adam Scott, also on his fourth sponsor invite into these most lucrative events. And you can all justify with those guys why they are deserving of those kind of sponsor exemptions, but they are also policy board members of the PGA Tour in an era where opportunities are dwindling for the rank and file. So the optics look pretty poor from my standpoint. Do you think the Tour needs to seriously look at more stringent limits on how many of those invitations a player can accept or what they might have to give in return for accepting them?
I think that's probably the way to answer your question is to say, okay, maybe we need to change the rules. Although I don't know that if I were one of these tournaments and I'm looking at what's best for business, I would have picked any two different players than the ones you're talking about right now, especially this week. I mean, you just said he lives on the seventh tee box and he is a huge member of our community. And it makes all the sense in the world for Webb to be here this week. And Adam Scott, everyone that's ever spent 2 minutes with Adam Scott can understand why you'd want him here. He is one of the more considerate people in the game, and he's an identifiable player. And we need to make good decisions for business right now, especially for the sponsors, given what we're going through in men's professional golf. But sure, if you made a rule or someone makes the rule that says, okay, you can't have more than two or three during the year, it would be great to see a Minwoo Lee playing here at Quail Hollow this week, or to see up and coming players in the game get more of an opportunity. I'd be fine with that. But as long as the rules are what they are right now, Eamon, I've got no problem with the current sponsors of these tournaments trying to do what's best for business.
And even yet, sponsors' exemptions have been debated for time immemorial. Much more ahead on this Monday edition of Golf Today with Taylor and Beth Ann Nichols right after this.
Continuing our conversation here with Golf Week senior writer Beth Ann Nichols and Sirius XM Radio's Taylor Zarzor. Beth Ann, we've seen some interesting storylines in the last couple of weekends. We've seen a 16-year-old make a cut on the PGA Tour. We saw a 15-year-old do it earlier on the Korn Ferry Tour. You've seen this a lot on the LPGA Tour over the years, where extremely young talent seems ready to compete at the highest level and is probably easily convinced that they're ready to compete at the highest level. But are there best practices out there that you've seen in the women's game that we ought to be keeping in mind just to stop these kids getting, I guess, out over their skis too early in their careers?
Well, I definitely think there's a big difference between the men's and the women's game. First of all, in terms of depth, it's unlikely that you're going to see a surge of teenagers in the men's game, you know, playing to that kind of level. From a physical standpoint, obviously boys mature at a slower rate in terms of their physical abilities compared to women, whereas as a 17, 18-year-old old on the LPGA can compete pretty much against anyone from a physical standpoint. So I think, you know, the LPGA has a commissioner's role. You know, you have to be 18 to play on tour, but you can request to play it earlier. But you pretty much have to win a tournament in order to get on tour before the age of 18, which is a really high threshold to meet. And I think it's hard to tell a player like that, look, you've already won on the LPGA. I'm sorry, you've got to wait a year or 6 months to come out. I don't really think that helps anyone. So I definitely think the LPGA actually has a good rule in place here.
Taylor, what do you think? I mean, as the father of three 12-year-olds, I can tell you that boys mature much slower physically and mentally, if at all, compared to women. You comfortable seeing these teenagers out there with the best players in the world?
You know, if a Scottie Scheffler or a Jordan Spieth or somebody plays in a one-off, Tiger Woods from time to time, we saw him playing as a teenager, then I think that's okay. I don't like to see them playing every single week. Akshay Bhatia maybe is an exception to the rule that seems to have handled going through every single phase of professional golf in the last 5 years to get to the highest level of men's golf, where he's here with us now in Charlotte this week. But he had to go through every single level. He didn't get to the big time and stay in the prime time of the game right from the word go, like Alexi Thompson or Lydia Ko or some of the others that we referenced earlier. It just feels like more time, more often than not, those players get burned out and they wish that they would have gone through all the normal phases of their life. So I think it's fine to see them play a couple of times a year, the best teenagers, but on a regular basis, I think there's some danger that comes with that.
Taylor, big week at Quail, I would imagine, with Wells Fargo on the way out, some potential sponsors paying close attention. Do you have that sense that this is an important week and sports week in the city of Charlotte, and how important what happens inside the ropes could be for the future of this event?
Yeah, everybody that's ever come to this town knows just how golf crazed we are in the Queen City. This is a very big deal. What Johnny Harris and the members at Quail Hollow have established is one of the premier tournaments on the PGA Tour. We have the PGA Championship coming back here next year, but your question is a good one. 2 years from now, what, if anything, does the tournament look like? Will it be a signature event? Will it have a new sponsor? Will we still have the best players in the world coming here? Will we have more of the best players in the world coming 2 years from now if unification happens? It is. It's a very big week for the tournament, and it's a very big week for the PGA Tour. Eamon mentioned earlier that Scottie Scheffler isn't here. Everyone's impressed with what Scottie Scheffler's doing, but maybe that means we'll have some drama with some of the other big-name players over the weekend that have a chance to win this. We certainly need it.
Bethan, speaking of big-name players, Brooks Koepka won again at the weekend on the LIV Tour in Singapore. He's defending the PGA next week. Over the weekend, Phil Mickelson tweeted and then deleted a vague threat that at some point LIV players might boycott majors if a direct pathway is not actually created for them and that none of these guys would show up. Can you ever envisage a time when a John Rahm or a Brooks Koepka will choose to boycott a major championship because a Taylor Gooch or a Joaquin Neiman is not getting a start in the field?
No, not at all. I think that's a bunch of bluster. You know, I don't anticipate something like that happen. I mean, look, you know, the majors are what define greatness. That's the ultimate legacy for any player, male or female. It all comes down to the majors. And so I don't see players bypassing a chance to tee it up in even one because of that. Look at how many are going to US Open qualifying. They're doing what they need to do to get there.
Taylor, listen, when a lot of guys left for LIV, they talked about growing the game and making it global. Listen, they took the bag, okay? It's pretty obvious to a lot of us. But your thoughts on what Brooks Koepka has been able to do, stay major championship sharp and winning four times out there.
Yeah, with Joaquin Neiman or Taylor Gooch or other players that have had success on LIV, I don't know that necessarily translates to success in major championships. But you're right, Damon. Koepka seems to be an exception to the rule. It seems like when he finds a little bit of form, like he did before last year's Masters on LIV, it did translate into an almost winning the Masters last year and then obviously winning the PGA Championship. I don't keep up with the odds as maybe as much as some others do, but I think I saw over the weekend, guys, that he's 20-1 going into the PGA Championship. How on earth could he be 20-1? If you're listing the people that have the best chance to win next week at Valhalla, you've got to think Scheffler, and then maybe after that, I think you would think Brooks Koepka and Rory McIlroy and Ludvig Åberg and Wyndham Clark and some others. But I fully expect him to have a chance to win a fourth PGA Championship next week. I'd be surprised if he isn't in the mix, given what he just showed us in Singapore.
Right with you. He went from 20-1, now 16-1 ahead of the second major of the year. Bethan, Taylor, we always appreciate it. Have a great Monday.
Thank you, guys.
Thank you.
Well, we're making the turn here on Golf Today. Special day out at Pinehurst as we gear up for the 124th U.S. Open Media Day underway. We're going to catch up with the Chief Championships Officer, John Bodenhammer. He knows what's happening down there. John is with us next. Well, U.S. Open Media Day is currently underway down in Pinehurst, North Carolina. Let's flash back to the 2023 edition of the Los Angeles Country Club. Wyndham Clark took the title after shooting 10 under par 270. That was enough to beat Rory McIlroy by a single stroke. It was his first major title victory and just his seventh major start. For the week, he had 110 putts, fewest in the field, second in driving distance at 325.7 yards, and tied ninth in greens in regulation. And that's a recipe that works just about anywhere.
No doubt, Eamon, next month, Pinehurst number 2 will be home to the U.S. Open for the fourth time in 25 years. The Pinehurst U.S. Open will mark the first time in over a century the USGA has awarded 4 U.S. Opens to a single site in a span of 25 years. Championships Officer John Bodenhammer from Pinehurst number 2 on Media Day. It's great to see you. First of all, I'm curious, a little more than 1 month out, John, in terms of the amount of sun and rain and how the golf course is looking, what's top of mind for you?
Well, top of mind is this magnificent Donald Ross gem with these magnificent putting greens. It's a little soft and wet right now. We had quite a bit of rain the last couple days, but by the time June rolls around, we're hoping that what Mr. Ross intended here playing firm and fast will be the case. It looks magnificent.
On the subject of how it's going to play, John, if you go back to the 99 Open, it was 7,175 yards. In 05, 7,215. In 2014, 7,562. You see a trend emerging here, John. What's the number this year?
The number, Eamon, is 7,540 yards. And, you know, you think about 2014, I've been asked what's different than 2014. Not much. We have new champion Bermuda grass on the putting greens. We narrowed the 13th fairway 12 yards, and we leveled out imperceptibly a couple of teeing areas. Other than that, it's going to play pretty much the same, albeit 20 yards shorter.
How much is the spirit of what Bill Corr and Ben Crenshaw did when it reopened in March of 2011 and was closed for a year, the widening of the fairways, for example, the elimination of the rough, how much does that spirit of the work that Corr and Crenshaw did to restore this Donald Ross gem remain?
It remains in a big way, Damon. Part of our strategies are to go to these great cathedrals of the game and follow the intent of the architect, what Donald Ross intended. You know, Donald Ross was so prolific. You think about what is here at Pinehurst, and he lived here. This was his masterpiece. This was his gem. And for a couple of decades, it went away. It was covered up with Bermuda grass, all the sandy natural areas. What Bill and Ben did about a decade ago, a little more than that, to restore it is just magnificent. The strategy, the routing, the angles, the firm and fast. You know, Donald Ross called these roughs with wiregrass and sandy areas the perfect rough because the randomness that it leaves with players who hit it in, not knowing what they're going to get. And we love it because it creates a little bit of anxiety or fear if you miss a fairway.
John, you were closely involved in the Open when it was last there 10 years ago, 2014. Now, that Open was followed the next week by the Women's Open. Were there any considerations that you had back then in terms of setting up the golf course, and are any compromises you had to make with those circumstances that you don't actually have in mind this year?
No, I don't think there are any compromises, Eamon. But I do think in 2014, we really wanted to showcase the women's game in a new way. We'd never had back-to-back championships before, open championships, as you know. And we really wanted to showcase the women's game. And so we really showed the women the same golf course for the most part that we played the men, about 600 yards shorter, but predominantly the same hole locations, the same firmness, the same green speeds, the same everything. And we don't have that this year. We will in 29 when we come back for back-to-back. But I don't think there were any challenges in that manner then that are present here. And we're just really excited. We think that what Mr. Ross intended here, particularly with these magnificent putting greens, is really going to shine and identify a great champion.
Speaking of which, for great championships like this one, you want to see a crescendo of a finish. Just how would you describe the last few holes and what we might see come Father's Day Sunday?
Well, you will see that crescendo. You know, you've got 15, a par 3 with a wicked putting green that anything can happen. 16 is a brutal 500-plus-yard par 4. Viewers might remember Michelle Wee made double bogey in the Women's Open to cut into her lead. She ended up winning, but a very difficult golf hole. And then 17, that iconic par 3, play about 200 yards downhill to that magnificent putting green. And then 18, where Payne Stewart, which is behind me, Payne Stewart made history and others have over the years. It's a U.S. Open finish. You need to golf your ball into the hole on those final four holes. Whoever wins will earn it.
John, Payne Stewart's probably more synonymous with Pinehurst in the modern era than any other golfer. It is 25 years since he won the Open and then tragically died a few months later in a plane crash. Are there any plans to commemorate Payne Stewart during the week of the Open?
Thank you for that question, Eamon. Yes, there are. We will honor Payne in a number of understated ways. You'll see in the players' locker room, they'll see some things and feel some things about Payne. We'll do some things on the golf course in a very understated way. And then throughout the week for the fans, we have a number of plans. We'll honor him with class and dignity and the great victory that it was. And think about it, 25 years ago, we were at Pinehurst for that great win, and we're back 25 years later for the first U.S. Open at our first anchor site, and we're awfully proud of that. We'll have his wife Tracy and their family with us during the week as our guests, as well as his caddy Mike Hicks and his family, and we look forward to a great celebration.
John, the build-out behind you looks a lot different than it would have in 1999, for example, when Payne Stewart won the U.S. Open. It looks a lot different in my eye to what it did in 2014. How much bigger has this U.S. Open become compared to a decade ago?
It's an interesting question, Damon. You know, Pinehurst is our biggest site from a space perspective, from a fan attendance standpoint. I think on the Saturday of the U.S. Open in 2014, we had about 60,000 people on the golf course. When you add up 50,000 fans and then on top of that, volunteers and security and players and so on and so forth. This year, it'll be a little less than that by design. We want the fan experience to be premium. We want the player experience to be premium. So we'll be a little shy of that, but we can do more here in this big site. And I think what's behind me, the grandstand, our new 1895 club, which is premium viewing, right on the 18th green. Across from that, you'll see a new hospitality village with perhaps the biggest scoreboard in major championship golf. It's going to be amazing with video and the like. This place will be rocking and rolling on the weekend, and it will be ruckus, and it will be a great celebration, whoever wins our National Open, and we'll get a worthy champion.
There's a lot of conversation, recurring conversation, John, about the criteria that major championships use to fill their fields, and a lot of it's complaints from LIV players that that qualification needs to be updated to give them a direct route into the field, that, that what is used is no longer fit for purpose. Do you see any changes coming in the US Open criteria, or are you happy with how things stand in terms of the pathways available through qualification?
Eamon, we generally, we will always, every year, first look at all of our exemptions, our entry criteria, our eligibility criteria for the U.S. Open and all of our championships each and every year. We put it through a review over the winter. We come out generally in February or March and announce what any changes that we've made. And then we continue to look at it leading up to the championship. We look at play leading up to the championship. We look at every factor we can from, and we're continuing to do that. Whether something will change or not is yet to be determined. And we'll watch in the future weeks, but we like where we are, and we'll continue to watch until we get closer to the championship.
John, a U.S. Open media day for a member of the Fourth Estate, it might mean a tee time this afternoon at number two. What do you want to accomplish on U.S. Open media day?
I think for us, for people to understand the culture that's here in Pinehurst, you know, Donald Ross, this was his masterpiece. He said many years ago that once a country gets golf-minded, it needs not worry about the honesty, integrity, and honor of its people. Pinehurst might not be a country, but it's a place, a very special place. Southern hospitality, it's a golf place. When you come here, you feel golf. I believe that if every young person could grow up on a golf course, the world would be a better place. Pinehurst is that type of place. And we conveyed that today at Media Day. We conveyed the greatness of this wonderful venue. And I think this year will be extra special because it is the 25th anniversary. Payne will be watching from above, and we'll have another iconic and special champion.
As you mentioned, it is one of your anchor sites for USGA championships going forward. John, it's only going to be 5 years until the next Open rolls around at Pinehurst in 2029. The new rules governing golf balls will have kicked in the year before. Is it safe to assume that by the time we're next in Pinehurst, that the competitors will be using or obeying different specifications for a golf ball?
I think that we're going to watch all of that very closely. We'll see how that trends. But we're not looking at it for just one U.S. Open. We're looking at it over the course of time and what that will mean for not only golf course setup, but fan experience and everything. It's an important part of what we do, the governance of the game. And so, yeah, we're looking at it closely. But I think Pinehurst will stand the test of time. You know, length is one thing. It's certainly length. It always matters. But I think this golf course, our strategies are built around these magnificent putting greens, being firm and fast. And I think that's where Pinehurst will stand the test of time.
And the USGA has also been building out an organizational presence in the village of Pinehurst as well, beyond just naming it as an anchor site for championships. What exactly are you guys doing down there as an organization?
Well, we're proud to open this Friday our new golf house, Pinehurst building. We'll have 65 of our team members down here that will be here, permanent members of the community. We also will open our USGA Experience and World Golf Hall of Fame right across the street from the Pinehurst Resort and Country Club Clubhouse. We're part of this place. And 1.5 million visitors a year will go right by our offices, our equipment test center as well. And we're proud of that. And I think we're members of this community, and it's important to us. We've built a lot of trust here. We're going to expand on it. Our legacy program that will leave a great impact on this community once we're gone, and we'll build on that as we come back for each U.S. Open and U.S. Women's Open and other future championships. We've got a run of championships over the next 25 years that will be magnificent, both Opens and Amateurs. And each one of them, we will make what we do here better, continuous improvement, what we put underground, what we do for the fan experience, and what we do for the player experience. We actually, in the locker room, the club renovated the locker room for the players. There's a tunnel now that leads right from the locker room to the first tee. It's magnificent, and the player experience will be enhanced because of it.
Can't wait to see it all, John. I know it's a busy time for you. The golf course looks great behind you. Also, the navy jacket and pink shirt, strong presentation as well. We'll see you next month. Thanks for the time.
Thanks, Damon and Eamon. Look forward to seeing you soon. Thanks for having me on.